My name is Gillian Terry. I'm assistant professorial lecturer and one of the deputy directors of LSE 100, which is the flagship interdisciplinary course that's taken by all first-year undergraduates at LSE. With my colleague Chris Blunt, we are the co-organizers of this conference, and I'll be chairing this panel this afternoon. And we are absolutely delighted to have three experts in interdisciplinarity with us this afternoon to share their insights and to have a conversation about the future of interdisciplinary education. So firstly, we have Professor Dilly Fung, who's currently serving as Pro-Director for Education at LSE, which is a role that she first took up in July of 2018. In her role as Pro-Director, Dilly oversees student education across the school and also serves as professor in practice at the LSE School of Public Policy. And her academic work draws on her very own interdisciplinary roots in English, politics, and the philosophy of education. Next, we have Professor Carl Gombrich, who's the academic lead and director of teaching and learning at the London Interdisciplinary School, which is a new university in London, which will admit its first cohort of students later this year. Prior to joining LIS, Carl worked at UCL as professorial teaching fellow in interdisciplinary education, where he established the Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences degree program for undergraduates, and his own education and teaching experience spans math, physics, philosophy, and music. Finally, we have Dr. Jessica Templeton, who's associate professorial lecturer and director of LSE 100. Jessica is a political scientist by training, and her research investigates global environmental politics and the regulation of hazardous chemicals. She also works as an editor, writer, and team leader for the Earth Negotiations Bulletin, a nonpartisan publication that analyzes UN multilateral environmental negotiations. So thank you to all of you for coming and joining us this afternoon. So for the format of today's panel, I have a few questions that will sort of kick off our conversation. So Dilly, I am going to start with you. I'm going to put you on the spot here. So the second chapter of your book, Connected Curriculum, is devoted to talking about interdisciplinary programs and projects. So can you tell us, in your view, what is an interdisciplinary education?
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, starting off with a simple question. I would say, I mean, we all of us think about knowledge and disciplines and how we investigate the world through the lens or lenses that we have learnt about the world through, as it were. So I bring to this question my background. Originally, I studied English literature, I studied politics and political philosophy, and then I studied philosophy of higher education, various connections between those fields. And for me, interdisciplinarity is not just, at least, not just about bringing different types of knowledge into the same space. It is that. It's about bringing experts and insights, evidence and approaches from different disciplines into one space. But for me, it's more profound than that. It's about stepping out of those normalized ways of thinking and practicing into another space where we ask some of the questions behind the questions. So for me, the question behind the question is, what does it make sense to say that we know? How can we claim to know something? What is the answer to that question from your discipline? What is the answer to that question from my discipline? What is the meeting place between these? And of course, that touches on different types of methodological approaches to investigating. And, you know, to simplify, we talk sometimes about qualitative and quantitative approaches. But of course, really, there's much more nuance. There are many variations. There are many, many intersections between those different approaches. But for me, a truly interdisciplinary approach and the value of interdisciplinary approaches is to step into that space where we can look at some really fundamental questions about what does it mean to know? What does it mean to maybe solve this problem that we've been presented with? What does it mean to really address this issue by thinking in a very nuanced way about what it makes sense to say that we know?
Thanks, Dilly. Yeah, I think that's a great way to kick us off. Carl, would you like to follow up on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great answer from Dilly. Very, very rich. And my temptation is sort of jump in and kind of agree and critique and add and so on. But I'll give the simple one first of all. The sort of literature answer is that an interdisciplinary education helps you to tackle problems using two or more disciplines to achieve a result or a product or an outcome that would not have been possible using just one of the disciplines. It's kind of as simple and as kind of clear-cut as that in one way, but that, of course, opens the door to all the really interesting things that Dilly has said, and I really liked all the points she raised. One part of that, and it's just a sort of phrase Dilly didn't use, but it was inherent in what she said, was the idea of multiple perspectives on things. So, and goes with that as a kind of empathy, which can start with a kind of disciplinary empathy, i.e. you can learn to see the world through the lens of, say, an economist, but they tend to be pretty mathematical about things these days. So can you be academically empathetic to, say, a kind of qualitative sociologist who might fundamentally disagree with the economist on, say, solving poverty or something like that? And then can you, in your own mind, inhabit both those positions? That's kind of true empathy. But from a kind of intellectual starting point, having kind of intellectual empathy with both positions, and then, as someone clever once said, being able to hold in your own mind these sort of two contradictory positions without kind of imploding or exploding. And I think sort of pedagogically, or in terms of development, that's a very rich thing to experience, something we would all hope to aim for as educators. But also practically, it probably leads to, well, there's many evidence, a piece of evidence actually, which show that it does lead to more nuanced solutions, to making less bad mistakes, not very glamorous thing to say, but very important thing to say, not diving in just to one perspective, but being aware that that perspective may be wrong from certain other perspective. And so being able to have a more rounded view of the whole picture. And just one more comment on there then is that I just use the word evidence, and that is really important. So Dilly talked about knowing, which is sort of epistemology. And of course, a big part of knowing is knowing what evidence looks like or means in your particular discipline. So gathering data in some way and how you use that as evidence for knowing is also a very important part of learning to be an interdisciplinary person, and therefore needs to be an important part of interdisciplinary education along the methodological lines, I think, which Dilly outlined, is what does it mean to have different methods in different disciplines, and what does it mean to gather those methods to supply evidence from those disciplinary perspectives.
Thank you, Carl. I wonder if we might want to turn then to thinking about the role of these sorts of ideas and concepts in shaping the way that we teach and the way that students learn. So maybe, Jessica, if you want to come in to sort of think about, I guess, how, you know, could you give us an example maybe of how interdisciplinarity and understanding interdisciplinary education in this way shapes the way that students learn on LSE 100?
Sure, I certainly can. I think this is probably true not just on LSE 100, but I think in any context when you're trying to achieve interdisciplinary learning, you're really trying to bring together different kinds of evidences, as Carl mentioned, different ways of knowing, and really get students to think about the assumptions that might otherwise go unrecognized, I think, in any, especially when we're doing specific disciplinary education or even two disciplines that are quite similar. And so I think basically when we're trying to achieve interdisciplinary learning for ourselves or teaching, we're trying to basically take a problem. I mean, on LSE 100, we take case studies and we analyze them from different disciplinary perspectives. And so, for example, a few years ago, we were looking at markets and we looked at them as both sort of an economic construct, and then we looked at them as something that you would explore from a sociological perspective, something that was more social and relational and understood. And it really, I mean, by looking at the market in these two different ways, it really enhanced and deepened all of us, I think, for teachers just as much as the students. It really enhanced our understanding of what a market is, what the impact is, how they are kind of implemented around the world, and so on. And I think that is really the goal when you find yourself looking at things from a totally different perspective and having these moments where you all of a sudden see the world in a very different way, and then you're synthesizing the insights from these different perspectives. And I think that is kind of the crux of interdisciplinary education, is when you're taking all of these different insights and putting them together and coming up with something new.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess on the back of that, what are the challenges of implementing this? We have these really lofty ambitions, right, about what interdisciplinarity is and how we can help our students to embrace these different disciplinary perspectives, you know, and use different types of evidence and methods and all of this, and synthesizing insights, which is, you know, super important and valuable. But what are the challenges? Why is it sometimes so difficult to implement this from the perspective of, say, a higher education institution?
Very broadly, there are two huge challenges. One is the sort of conceptual thing of how to make it work from all the richness that you've heard. I mean, even in sort of 5 minutes, there's so much richness there. How do we bring this together in a way which is graspable, really, and learnable for relatively young learners? And then there's the sort of bureaucratic piece about institutions and Dilly referred to, is what we've come to think of as the way we divide knowledge in various disciplines, and the whole structure from your A-levels or even your IB, although that's very broad. A-levels are a bit of a disaster in this respect from a global perspective. Very narrow training, sort of up to 18, and then even narrower departments at universities, how we then kind of break that apart and restructure it from a way which is still sort of coherent and kind of meaningful to students. And those are very deep questions, because I'm not against disciplines per se. I mean, I do think they've done amazingly well. It's just that two things for me: in a time of great change, extraordinary changes that the internet and kind of globalization in general is doing to the way we think about knowledge, that's one thing. And also in a time when so many people are going to university, to have them just doing these very narrow, old-fashioned bands of knowledge is just weird. It's plain weird. But we don't really have a new way to structure things which is kind of as cohesive as the discipline. So we stuck with them because they're cohesive, while we recognize that they're kind of weird in today's context. And so we all kind of need to work out how we get more fluid, how we offer more agility, more freedom to students, but also how we offer kind of new structures so that they do cohere both in the minds of the students and institutionally, so the institution is able to offer coherent kind of new interdisciplinary packages to students. But I, as I say, I could just talk forever, so I will try and let my other colleagues say something else on this now.
I'm happy to chip in with some comments. First of all, I completely agree again, Carl, with what you said, for sure. I think one of the challenges is organisational, one of the reasons why, when I wrote about the idea of a connected curriculum, I focused on the idea of a kind of core through line, a kind of anchor, an anchor space. And I've recently been talking to the UK Quality Assurance Agency, actually, about developing some ideas around how we can have much more fluid space through a centre of our degree structures, to enable students to have more space to develop and explore and fail and just move into more fluid spaces with their knowledge, more connective spaces. And one of the reasons I think it's really helpful to have that kind of structure is that what we can then do is help students think at that meta level about what does it mean then that over here in this course I'm studying in this way about this topic, and over here on this course I'm studying in this way about this topic, and they are taking different types of approaches. And when they use the word evidence, they're using something that is something different from what they mean by evidence over there. And instead of pretending that doesn't happen and sort of, you know, brushing it under the carpet as if it's some sort of naughty secret that one shouldn't really confess to, it's much more interesting and much more productive to foreground that and problematize it, but in a really creative way. So here's some really creative possibilities about how we could bring these ideas together. And one other reason why I think that kind of structural approach is really important is it gives spaces to think about the way in which we use language. So we know that academic literacy is not a thing, really. It's academic literacies. So you are literate in one kind of discipline when you can use certain phrases and certain types of vocabulary in certain formats, and you can create, you know, you can express that in certain particular formats on the page. And that would actually not be appropriate or not be appreciated or certainly not be normal in another discipline. And sometimes even in quite apparently cognate disciplines, there are really very different approaches to those sorts of things. So again, it's what's challenging is that we don't provide the space normally in the structures of our degree programs to foreground this, to help students understand it at that sort of meta level and to think, this is really interesting. What can I think about? You know, how can I connect that? How might I draw on these sorts of different ideas and different ways of speaking and knowing and expressing ideas and expressing knowledge in when I investigate or when I think about the big world problems or a thesis or dissertation that I might want to undertake. And I think I think in order for us to progress with more interdisciplinary education, we have to get some structures right so that we can support students to really thrive in those interdisciplinary spaces.
Very briefly, can I kind of build on that, Gillian? So I completely agree with what Carl and Dilly have said. And I would say, I mean, in an ideal world, you have something like the project that Carl is leading on, where you have an entire university that's, kind of centered on interdisciplinary learning. In, say, LSE, one of the things I would love to see, I mean, with LSE 100, it's a first year course, but I would love to see a second year course and a third year course that, you know, are kind of advancing students' ability to kind of continue to apply these skills. So it's not something you kind of learn and then you kind of shift your attention away from as you get very deep into your own area of expertise, which is also fine to do, but it would be quite nice in I think in any university to have, as Dilly's talking about, some sort of structure that runs across all of the years that is still engaging students in interdisciplinary thinking. And so that's a very practical, very practical answer to your question, but I think that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the structures are key to all of this, because if we look at institutions around the world, for example, you know, I did my undergraduate degree in Canada, where I had the opportunity to change my major, you know, half a dozen times if I wanted to. And it didn't put me out. It didn't cost me more money. It didn't really do anything. It all it allowed me to do is explore, right, and investigate new questions and decide what I wanted to focus on. And I think in some contexts like the UK, that is much more challenging for students to do without those structures, as you say, Dilly, in place for them to have the opportunities to do that. I'm going to move on to maybe what is a slightly controversial question. I don't know. Maybe not for this audience. But I guess at universities around the world, we do already see students on interdisciplinary programs in a wide range of fields, you know, gender studies and health and the environment and beyond. So in your view, are we already in a post-disciplinary world? And while hyper-specialization might be the order of the day in some disciplines like math and physics, what do you think is the future of the discipline in social sciences? Another big question from me. Who would like to kick us off?
I can start us off, I suppose. I'd say we're definitely not in a post-disciplinary world at all in any way, especially in, you know, I suppose that depends on where you are largely. But I think one of the challenges of some of these, some areas have been more successful at being broadly interdisciplinary than others. And so I would say some areas maybe have very similar disciplines coming together, and that's sort of considered to be interdisciplinary. But to have that real breadth of perspective is hard. It's challenging. It's challenging to get people to work together and to understand each other. Not, I mean, it's almost easier in an, I would say, in an educational context when you're deliberately trying to put together different perspectives and invite students into those contrasts than it might be when you're doing broadly different interdisciplinary research that actually draws on very different perspectives. And we have seen some great examples of that in the research and in literature that's come out. But on the whole, we're not, even within disciplines, we're not necessarily very good at speaking across divisions, you know, across subfields and so on. So I think we have a ways to go on that, even though I like the idea very much that we would be moving in that direction.
Yeah, I'll chip in and you know, just really agree with Jessica. I like the idea that we would be moving in that direction. I think we have some way to go before we really make progress. I think there's no doubt that there are some areas of study that are really fields rather than disciplines. So if I take something like education as an example, you can go and study education, say at the Institute of Education up the road from LSE at UCL, and you can study education from a sociological point of view, from a philosophical point of view, from a psychological behavioral science point of view, and many others. And so it's a field, but there are still practices that are disciplinary within that field. And depending on what you study and how you study, you may see that as a kind of coherent, interestingly diverse landscape of ways of thinking that you kind of make some sense of. Or you still might specialise very early, even though you're studying a field, in, say, psychology or sociology in that space. And it's about creating the space in the curricula for, as you pointed out yourself, Gillian, you know, if we're having some time to explore those different territories before, and that those meeting places, as you say earlier, I refer to this on occasions, but I always liked from philosophy, Gadamer, German philosopher Gadamer, talked about Horizontverschmelzung, which is the meeting of horizons, and the idea that we can learn and transform ourselves. We transform our understanding of the world through standing, to put it simply, standing where someone else stands for a little while, or at least standing more closely to them on their mountain than you have done before, so that the horizon that you're looking at is more similar and more connected with the horizon that they see. And it's about going back to that point about disciplinary empathy and those connecting spaces. So we may have a number of fields that are quite broad now, but they don't always have those real opportunities for those meeting points. And we just need to ensure that that does happen both within the field and then within the specialist areas. There are also those connecting points across to other specialisms.
Yeah, that's a very interesting distinction between the field and the discipline. And we see sustainability might be another good example of a field which is sort of inherently too broad to ever really be fully disciplined. But that's an interesting question, because it seems sort of inevitable that things become disciplined over time, and design thinking is another example, which seems to be sort of pretty post-disciplinary, that it sort of draws on whatever it can and wants to do its thing in design thinking. But it's also sort of becoming a discipline in that there are journals now dedicated to design thinking. So this seems to be sort of part of the trajectory of the evolution of knowledge in general, if you like. I feel we are a period in history, though, where we sort of have no idea where this is going to land or settle next. And greatest sociologist, the Mila Hartmann-Rosa and so on, have written about this. And it's so obvious in some ways to the people on this panel, I'm sure I don't need to repeat the things about acceleration of rate of change and accumulation of knowledge and so on. They're just in kind of exponential phase, and there's so much fluidity that it does seem very hard to know what comes after our existing disciplinary structures at the moment. One thing I like to say, one of my sort of sound bites, if you like, is that so many graduates I see now are experts because of their interdisciplinarity, not in spite of it. So what they do is they combine two or three unique areas, and this is a way of thinking actually that comes out of the MIT Media Lab as well, which is completely theirs, and they're completely kind of go-to people for the consultancy world, the business world, the commercial world, even the government world. They don't find it very easy to fit into academia because they're combining, say, neuroscience, architecture, aesthetics, and computer modeling to understand kind of the built environment's effect on our minds and how we might make better places for us to live and be. Now, that's an example actually picked from UCL called Ecological Brain, PhD program. So maybe those graduates will have a kind of home afterwards, but it's hard because there are so many of these kind of interesting new combinations you can make, which are very valued, and everyone gets the relevance and excitement of it. But how do you kind of restructure, back to the restructuring question, everything so that we have some kind of stability and some kind of career structures for those students? So I don't really know what post-disciplinary might mean, because we need some structures which educate people and lead them somewhere. But we're certainly in a state of incredible flux, with kind of big fields being more relevant than narrow disciplines, but without quite knowing how this shakes down in the next 10, 20, 50 years, I guess.
Sorry, Jillian, can I just say one more thing about this? What Carl was saying really made me think also about how some of the big external pressures and challenges that we're facing these days require an interdisciplinary approach. So, environmental change, AI, some of these things, these problems are transformative on a global scale now. And so I just wonder how much of that is going to actually incentivize change within our education systems or within our research as well, because we simply can't tackle these problems from one perspective.
Yeah, can I just add another point to that, actually? I'm going to refer back to something that I know Carl led on very wonderfully when he was at UCL, which was the Bachelor of Arts and Sciences program there. And I still remember so vividly, Carl, the experience of your students producing videos when they had come back from their work placements, explicitly talking about how their interdisciplinary thinking had impacted their role in the workplace. And it was so wonderful. I remember being really moved by it and thinking this is one of the most profound examples of education, real education, that really changes someone, their notion of themselves, their notion of the world of knowledge, of how they might approach the workplace, professional roles and so on. A really, really wonderful example. And again, it just comes back to that point about giving students the opportunity explicitly to be able to consider at that sort of meta level what that's all about and to be able to articulate it to others.
Thank you. I think there's so much there we could pick up on. And I know before we move into that, I will ask one sort of final question that I think leads actually quite nicely on from what you've just said, Dilly and Jessica, around the sort of value added of interdisciplinary education. So what unique or distinct advantages does an interdisciplinary education give to students? So that could be something about their careers, their next steps, where they end up in their work, or it could be something bigger about, you know, how they think about the world, how they tackle big problems in their lives or that, you know, in our societies. If you could sort of, you know, sum it up, what would be the sort of value added for each of you in terms of what interdisciplinary education is really giving to students?
So I think there are many things, but I'll keep it brief. I think one of the key things for me is the ability to step across into different spaces when necessary. So, and what that means in the workplace and for life in general is the ability to understand that change and difference are not intrinsically threatening, but can be stimulating opportunities for creativity and can be an opportunity to draw from one's various lenses or through, you know, look through one's various lenses and bring those things together to really deal with change. And when we talk to employers now, they talk all the time about the uncertainties of the workplace, and what they want to see are people who can come and will be prepared to deal with fresh challenges on day two that hadn't been there a week ago. And I think that's one of the strongest, or a very strong outcome of interdisciplinary learning.
So I would add to what Dilly has said and just say that I think one of the great things about interdisciplinary learning is that it helps people develop confidence in areas that they didn't know that they were good at before. They often have a chance to explore things. I mean, all of us, most of us get onto a track sometimes and decide we're good at some things and not so good at other things. And often it's because we haven't really had enough exposure to the other things to find out we are good at them or we find them interesting or like them. And so I really appreciate when, from a very educational perspective, I really appreciate when we find that students discover something new that they like, or they're building confidence. And I feel like, just as Dilly said, it does help them to kind of see complexity and nuance in problems. And I think that is something that we need in society desperately these days, especially these days, more than ever. Perhaps we really need to be able to recognize nuance and also recognize the limitations of our own understanding of a problem. And I think that's one thing that interdisciplinary thinking can do.
If you had your sort of one thing that you would say is the value added, I mean, again, this is a big one.
Yeah, I mean, we're sort of furiously all agreeing on this panel, aren't we? A bit too much. And I guess that's inevitable. But no, I do agree with what my colleagues have said. And I think, again, a little bit of a cliche, but being comfortable outside your comfort zone because of all the uncertainties and change is such a huge deal for graduates these days. And the earlier students can learn to be comfortable outside their comfort zone, as many of us are in our work, the better. And interdisciplinarity will certainly do that for you. And complexity. I mean, interdisciplinarity is sometimes accused of wanting to have its cake and eat it in every way. It's like, what are its real sort of meta-level commitments? I think one meta-level commitment is that we do believe the world is complex. We believe, difficult as it is, we should try to educate students to understand complexity and live with complexity, which isn't actually on the agenda for many, many individual disciplines. And interdisciplinarity will sure shake you up and make you see just how complex it is to get people to agree on assumptions, evidence bases, all the things we've already talked about. So I think that's a big value add for interdisciplinarity, is getting students to start to think deeply and feel deeply issues of complexity.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think we are all agreeing on this panel, but I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. It's nice to sort of have a sense of a direction of travel for what, you know, interdisciplinary education might bring in the future. And actually, our very first question is sort of future looking in this way. So Rian asks us to think about what the future of an interdisciplinary education should look like and what changes we might need to make in order to get there. I think we've talked about that somewhat around questions related to structure. I'm going to just read out the other two questions and then you can just pick and choose what you'd like to respond to. Claire Gordon asks, how can we navigate the tension between what we prize as success in the academic research world and what you're suggesting is desirable educationally to address big global challenges? So that tension between what is seen as, you know, traditionally successful in academic research and what we sort of all agree is important on it, the interdisciplinary education side. And then finally, a question from Judith Shapiro. To what extent is the qualitative quantitative divide part of that challenge? So three big questions. Again, pick up on what you'd like. Maybe we'll start with you, Dilly, on this one, and we'll go around just 2 or 3 minutes each, and then we'll wrap up.
Hard to choose. I'm going to say something controversial about quantitative, qualitative. You shouldn't really do that when you've only got short time, should you? I think there's a lot of nonsense talked about qualitative versus quantitative. In most real cases, you can have very complementary approaches through those different angles. But I think where the divide does start to kick in as a problem is where people do not accept the idea, this is going to be controversial, that numbers are inherently meaningless until someone has ascribed a meaning to them. And if you're going to ascribe a meaning to numbers, you have to use language. And as soon as you use language, you are adopting a qualitative position, because language is never transparent. Language is always affected by nuance and judgment in the delivery of that language, and can create lots of different inferences. So I think there are some issues over singular ways of thinking in one or other of those sorts of things that we need to get past. But I think we need to kind of take a big step back and look at what it really makes sense to say that we know, going back to my earlier point.
Thank you, Dilly. I like the controversy personally. Who would like to go next? Carl, would you like to jump in?
Yeah, interesting. I'd love a philosophical debate with Dilly on that. She says we don't have time. I'm not sure I disagree with that, just a bit more tangential. I mean, as you may know, 60% of our new curriculum is methods, and we have split them into qualitative and quantitative simply because that's easily understandable and kind of works. But we are thinking about other ways of passing this, actually, and one might be image, number, and language. Now, Dilly might say to us, number and language is one thing and you can have image. I don't know, but there are certainly other ways that we should look at this. There are some interesting thinkers on methodology out there. And there are certainly many people now, for example, people working in recognition of images through machine learning who understand that the quantitative won't capture everything they need to about the image. So there are all sorts of interesting interdisciplinary challenges to the current distinctions of methodology. So that, for me, to answer partly the other question about the future, is it would be great if interdisciplinarity challenged some of these slightly tired categories of methodology, which we work with because we kind of inherently understand what they mean, but they are sort of feeling a bit tired and like, can't we come up with more interesting ways of thinking about methodological categories? So that is something I would like to work on, which I hope answers two of the three questions. I've deliberately avoided the hardest question about the tension, but I've got an answer for that if we've got a minute at the end after Jessica's.
Yeah, go for it, Carl. We've still got time.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know if this is helpful for academia in a sense, but I do think that the best graduates going forward will look at academia and say it is a bit constricting, a bit narrow for me. I'm not sure I want a full-time job in academia. I'd like a kind of job where I can be a consultant on the side, also probably the pay is better and you get to choose what you do a bit more. And if then a university would take me sort of part-time or to do these other things, that would be great. Now, whether universities need that or want that, I don't know. If financially, I guess they're very solid, they may still just sort of go with what they know, which is sort of basically promoting from within and looking for the same old metrics they've been looking at for 30 years. But they may want to hang on to these people as actually the kind of catalyst for really creative change within the institution, in which case they've got to think of other career structures which encourage that kind of hybridity between the real world and the academy. And they've got to look at the right sort of people and give them the right kind of offers to encourage that those people to stick around and be there and have the careers that they want. So it's not a full answer by any means, I'm afraid, but it's a tricky answer. And I guess we have to think of something new, otherwise possibly universities will fall off a cliff at some point. They'll become increasingly irrelevant in some ways. I don't know. That may be provocative too. I don't know.
Thanks, Carl. Jessica, did you want to come in on this? Answer one or all of these questions.
Yikes. I'll try and tackle Claire's, although I agree that is an incredibly difficult question. And I do think that the structures of universities around what is rewarded, you know, kind of single author articles, things like that, that is going to have to change. Because if universities are really looking to tackle big, complex problems, as we've already said on this panel, there's going to have to be more collaboration, and it's going to have to be across disciplines. And so right now, in many disciplines, not all, but in many disciplines, obviously you are rewarded more for solo authored things than for collaborative work. And I think universities are just going to have to move beyond that if they want to continue to be relevant, to be kind of the source of solutions to, or you know, input and relevant insights into the problems that we're facing today. So I think it's going to have to change. I know that there will be a lot of resistance. Change is always difficult, and I know that it'll be hard, but I think we have to get there. And there are probably enough people who are really seeing that need and are excited by those opportunities that there will be good momentum from within universities. To Judith's question about the quant-qual divide, I would just say, building on what Dilly said, in LSE 100, we have really tried, I mean, this is my specific experience with this, but we have really tried to help students move beyond that and just dismiss it as much as we can. And so you really need to be able to understand quantitative and qualitative methods and evidence and data and so on. And you need to, you need to get to grips with the skills that are necessary to analyze these things and to understand them in a shorter way than what Carl is doing, obviously, with LIS, because we only have 1 year to do it. But that is something that we have been very aware of. And again, I do think this is a lot about confidence building for students, because they get stuck in a track and feel they're good at one thing and not good at the other. And then they choose not to engage. So, I mean, I think we've probably all been there at some point, those of us who would skip over the quant stuff when we were reading and so on when we were undergrads. So we're trying to move beyond that and just build confidence for students to help them really feel more comfortable so that they can actually read an article in the FT or in The Economist, and they can understand what that is. They can think critically about that article. So
can I just add a really quick comment, because it's so relevant to what you just said, Jess? I can see that Carl wants to add as well. But also to Carl's point about image and, you know, language and number. Of course, you know, the semioticians or semiologists would say that it's all language, that numbers are language, that words are language, that visual images are language. They're all types of language, or they're signs to which we ascribe meanings. And where we've been really bad, really, really bad, it's why I emphasize so much in education around the importance of showcasing through different forms and formats one's knowledge to diverse audiences through different types of channels. Where we've been so bad is we've adopted such a narrow way of expressing our knowledge, our findings, our solutions to narrow audiences in very inaccessible formats and forms and platforms. And so we must diversify how we express ourselves. And to me, that's all part of the interdisciplinary joy, that as well as expressing different types of knowledge coming together, you can genuinely find new forms and much more varied forms of expression using everything available to us in a digital age.
I completely agree with that. But just to challenge this sort of slightly qualitative shift we've had here, guys, and I know you'll like this sort of challenge. There's a wonderful paper by your very own Daniel Finelli at LSE, which basically argues that all knowledge is quantitative. So totally opposite to the interpretivist tradition. And the very simple reason is that if knowledge is to give you any information at all, qualitative, visual, then it's subject to information theory. And if it's meaningful, it's informational. And the informational means there's an information theory behind it. And it's a Royal Society paper. I urge everyone to, it's long, 50 pages, and I can't understand most, but you come away thinking, wow, that's a very strong position. So perhaps we'll put that alongside the interpretivist one and try and understand them both and teach our students to appreciate them both.
Thank you, Carl. And now we all have something to go away and read after today, which is always exciting. We are just...
Sorry about that.
So I do just want to extend my thanks again to all of you, to Dilly, to Carl, to Jessica, for coming along this afternoon and to sharing your insights and your perspectives on interdisciplinary education with the students who have taken part in today's conference, as well as our colleagues at LSE and beyond. So thanks to all of you, and to everybody, look out for the podcast, which will come out shortly, and share it far and wide. Thanks, everybody.